Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 129 with Paul Sloat on the second quarter market update. On these market update episodes, economist and financial advisor Paul Sloat of Greendrake Advisors presents us with compelling information to help guide us real estate investors in our day-to-day activities to maximize our gains and minimize our risk. It is through this information that Paul shares, along with a lot of other information that I've used to confidently continue investing in my real estate and my real estate investing business. As you've probably been hearing people talking about the recession and the market correction, and I continue to make these investments and they paid off, just as I hope you have. So one of my private lenders recently called and asked me what I do to help avoid risk on the deals I do. That is the deals he funds to help me do as well. Part of that answer can be found on these market update episodes. I pay attention to the happenings of the global economy in addition to each of the areas and the neighborhoods where I'm investing, to look out for events at the national and the global level that might impact my deals in a positive or negative direction and adjust accordingly. And those are some of the same things I've paid attention to over the years with Paul that have helped us grow Diamond Equity into the machine it is today in Atlanta, Chicago, and Philadelphia, doing, you know, between 200 and 300 deals per year. Today, Paul presents a ton of information that continues to help me guide my personal real estate and other activities. Happy to have it recorded to be able to share that with you today. Let's jump right in, shall we? All right. Welcome back to the show, Paul.
Well, thanks, Dan. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, it's been a while. We skipped our first quarter beginning end of the year session here. I kind of got a little busy with stuff, and I know you did too, but we circled around and we're here at the beginning of the second quarter. And so let's see what we have in store. A lot of big changes in the last 5-6 months or so since I've had you on the show.
Yep. And I think many of the things we talked about 5 or 6 months ago are actually starting to show through in the economy. So when we had last talked, we talked about the fact the Fed was pulling money out of the economy at the same time it was raising interest rates. And we indicated that that was usually not a good prescription for the economy. So what's going on? Well, the yield curve has partially inverted, which usually means you have a slowdown ahead at a minimum. In addition, the Conference Board's Index of Leading Economic Indicators indicate a slowdown ahead. Plus, on the international side, you've had a slowdown in Europe and also a slowing in China, which is now stabilizing and starting to reverse. So if we were to look ahead, we would expect the economy to continue to slow this year, but not necessarily have a recession. And the reason it probably won't have a recession is because, really one reason, China has massively stimulated their economy. They have input 5.5% of GDP into their economy. And because it is a command economy, unlike here in the U.S., when the people in charge say spend, people spend. So we see China's economic statistics beginning to turn, and we expect them to continue to turn. So that's one reason, and a primary reason, we think the U.S. will avoid a recession. Another reason is that the Federal Reserve in January reversed course. They were on a tightening course, and all of a sudden they said, oh, we don't need to tighten anymore. I think they finally saw the data that had been delayed by the government shutdown and the fight in the government over money. And I think they said, we better stop being so aggressive or we're going to tip the economy into a recession. So that's the next reason I think we're probably not going to have a recession. And then really the only other reason I think we're not going to have a recession is there's really no excesses here in the U.S. You have not seen real excess, in fact, except, and this is a big exception, except a little bit in the real estate area. And I'll talk about what I mean in a few minutes about that. But in general, we have not overinvested in any sector of the economy. And typically the things that tip us into recession are, number one, overinvestment into an asset class that's driving the economy, and then all of a sudden that investment stops, and then that flows through the economy, and that causes a recession. That is what happened in 2001 and 2002. We had a huge investment program into the economy in the late 90s as we built out the internet, and major corporations had to redo their whole computer systems because of Y2K. So this provided a big boost to the economy in the late 90s, and when it was over, it was over. And we had a recession as a result. In 2008 and 2009, we had a recession because we had a problem in the financial system that was very similar to the 91-92 recession. And both those recessions occurred because of lending on real estate assets that couldn't be supported by either the incomes of the people who were buying the real estate or, in the area of commercial real estate, the cash flows could not cover the interest. So those were financial-led recessions. The one in 2001-02 was a fundamental economy-led recession, and I don't see the excesses that would cause either a fundamental economy-led recession or a financial system-induced recession, unless the Fed were to significantly raise interest rates at this point and really squeeze the economy. So we probably won't have a recession, but we will have a slowdown. There are a couple of other things that people should be aware of. There is a global inventory cycle. That inventory cycle occurs for a bunch of reasons, but typically it runs 2 years up and 2 years down. And we would expect it to bottom sometime in the second half of 2019 and then start upward. And it's already started upward in some areas, and we expect that to spread more broadly across industry. So that should be positive for industry. The other thing that's going on is that on the global retail sales side, you have had sort of consistent demand, and that has allowed for inventories to drop and will support ultimately industry re-accelerating once the inventory correction is over. So we don't see a global recession ahead. We don't see a U.S. recession ahead, although we see a U.S. slowdown. Now, what's going to continue to carry the economy? In the U.S. here, there's a couple of things. I think number one is consumer spending. Consumer incomes are rising at 3.4% year over year, which is the fastest rate since before the last recession. And consumers are just seeing their incomes rise above where they were at the height of the last recession. So we don't see the Fed choking that off, and we see consumer incomes continuing to rise and support consumer spending. Also, as normally happens with the election cycle, public spending is accelerating. Now, politicians like to get reelected, So when they want to get reelected, they have to show the public they're actually spending their money in a way that provides tangible benefits to the public. And typically this comes through public works. And typically, politicians like to cut the tape at a variety of things in election years. So spending typically accelerates in the last 2 years of a presidential cycle. And this cycle looks no different than any other cycle. And it appears to us that spending is re-accelerating. Now, let's talk about the areas which are probably not going to contribute to economic growth much from here. One is auto sales. Auto sales are probably maxed out for the cycle, so they'll probably just go sideways like occurred in the late 1990s. We see housing and housing starts going sideways until the next economic upturn. And this is for really two reasons. Number one, if we look at the price of housing relative to incomes, it's kind of maxed out. And the other thing is we expect a gradual rise in interest rates this cycle, which will limit and offset a portion of the increase in consumer incomes in terms of qualifying for a mortgage. And the millennials are the biggest piece of buyers for homes today. They are the marginal buyer, and if interest rates go up and their income doesn't go up enough, they get rationed out. That is what happened this past fall when rates rose, and then all of a sudden new home and existing home sales dropped. And we expect this seesaw pattern and more of a sideways pattern as rates rise gradually and consumer incomes rise, and they offset each other. The other reason we think that housing prices are going to go sideways is housing prices are at record levels relative to incomes, and you can only squeeze a lemon so much. So we think that that's where we sit with individual housing. On the multifamily housing side, multifamily construction spending is at record levels. But the big issue on the multifamily side is if we look at the household formation data. The household formation data tell us, and we have it for 2018 now, or at least a portion of 2018, they show us that owner occupiers are growing at a very healthy clip, while renters are actually shrinking. So if owner occupiers are growing at, let's say, a 1.5 million clip, renters are only growing at a negative 200 to 300,000 clip. In other words, they're not growing at all, but shrinking across the country. And this has been occurring since Q4 2017. So when we look at the multifamily data, at least when we look across the country, what we see is the potential for a real problem should a recession occur. Because what could happen is that in a recession, the occupancies could drop, and this phenomena of more household formation into buying versus renting could continue, and we would have the deliveries of the record multifamily construction under construction today. So we think there could be a problem multifamily. The other area where we think that there almost definitely will be a problem when we get to recession, and we'll talk about when we think that will occur in a minute, is we think that the other area that's been, that has the potential for massive overbuilding is self-storage. Self-storage is building facilities at four times the rate it was at the peak of the last economic expansion. While we are not rocket scientists when it comes to self-storage, it seems to us that if you're adding a lot of capacity and you're adding it at a rapid rate, and there's a possibility for economic slowdown or recession, you're going to have trouble absorbing the capacity. And what people forget is that occupancy rates in multifamily have risen significantly, and that they could also drop in any kind of slowdown or especially in a recession. And as we know, when a building's half finished, typically it gets finished, so you then have additional capacity delivered during the recession. So for those two classes of real estate, we are not overly enthused, whereas for single-family homes, because of the movement of the millennials into their prime home buying years, we are quite positive. So let me talk about a couple of things that are going on in the background that real estate investors should keep an eye on, one of which is the evolution of the trade talks with China. As most real estate investors are aware, we buy many products from outside the United States that go into any form of rehab or construction. Should the talks with China deteriorate, all those products will get more expensive. In addition, the other piece people should be aware of is if the talks with China don't go successfully, there could be ripple impacts across the economy as China and the U.S. mutually retaliate against each other. Now, China, of course, has much more to lose than the U.S., but that doesn't mean the U.S. will not lose. The other international piece that investors should be aware of is currency. Emerging economies have a tendency to depreciate their currency in order to benefit themselves at the expense of other countries. We think that this type of action has gotten to the point where the United States will act to put an end to it over the next few years. That's because the U.S. needs to grow faster, which it can do if it wants to. So we expect an end to the ability of emerging economies to depreciate their currency, and that will have an impact on all the stuff that real estate investors buy. Because one of the reasons it stayed cheap is because emerging economies, when they have issues of growing their economy, have a tendency to lower the value of their currency to make them more competitive against other countries. By the way, that means the U.S. becomes less competitive, and we think that that will become a real issue over the next few years. And by the way, it's not just an issue for real estate investors. If you're a soybean farmer in Kansas, and Brazil has just depreciated its currency 50%, which it did last year, all of a sudden your soybeans are not competitive against Brazilian soybeans. And so maybe, just maybe, a country like China would buy Brazilian soybeans instead of American soybeans because they're a lot cheaper. So we think that this currency thing will come to a head over the next few years and could have significant repercussions for the cost of building things and the availability of products coming in from outside the country. So that's another wild card to keep your eye on. It's a little bit early days, but as best we can tell, we think that the current administration is going to address China first and then the currency second, probably in 2021 after the election. The other things that we think investors need to focus on are the tax cuts. The tax cuts helped grow the economy more quickly last year. Now, their impact has not fully gone away, but it will diminish over time. And the likelihood is by 2025, the government will need to raise money. It's going to be effectively broke because it will need to pay for social programs, which are massively underfunded, at the same time as it spends money on the military in order to counter the threat from China. So we see some sort of budget real crisis by the mid-2020s, at which point the government will raise taxes. So those are the things I really think that real estate investors should keep in mind. And oh, by the way, for those of you who pay attention to what's gone on overseas, you should take a look at what's going on in Berlin and the attempt to expropriate housing from landlords that legitimately own the housing. In Germany, the price of renting has gone through the roof. As voters vote, there is a chance that the voters will vote to have the government expropriate the real estate owned by private landlords in cities like Berlin.
Wow.
You should be aware that this is consistent with many other populist impulses that we've seen across numerous countries, including the U.S. So that's just something to keep in mind as we go forward, that things may not be as rosy as we think, and that people vote, and if rents get too high, they can vote to do something about it. And I think that's it for today, Dan. I'm sure you have a number of questions. You always do when I get done.
Oh, yeah. So I do get a couple of them, and I love the way we handle our conversation here, where you present the information. I hope the listeners follow along, and then we circle back and touch on a couple of the hot topics, because I like you to paint the entire picture first before I start interrupting you mid-sentence or anything like that. So the first one I wanted to touch on is you mentioned like currency risk. So these emerging economies depreciate their currencies. What, if any, would the United States do or have as leverage or, a power to combat an emerging economy depreciating currency? How would that
work? Here's how I think this will play out. I think once the negotiations with China are out of the way, and then we have some discussions with Europe, and that's a whole different kettle of fish, and we can talk about that offline because that's a can of worms. But I think once those are done, and after the 2020 election, the administration is going to focus on currency. Because imagine you're a U.S. company, and you put up a steel plant here, and a Brazilian company puts up a steel plant in Brazil, and you have about the same costs. But all of a sudden, the Brazilian currency is worth half as much as it was worth yesterday. All of a sudden, the Brazilian company can make money and undercut your pricing significantly, and you can lose money. So I think that that's a big issue, and I think that what the U.S. will do will go into the currency markets and flood the currency markets with currency and knock the value of the dollar down. By the way, that will be inflationary. And oh, by the way, if it's inflationary, it will impact overall interest rate. And by the way, remember on previous shows, we've talked about how interest rates have hit a long-term bottom and appear to have made a secular turn. And so more inflation would be one reason why we'd have a secular turn in interest rates. There are others, and we can talk about those as well, but does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it does. And just to point it out, the interest rates would rise if inflation is rising, correct, Paul?
Yep, that is normally what happens, at least until the point where the Fed gets upset about inflation and really squeezes and pushes the economy into a recession.
Gotcha. So I have some comments on the self-storage. I looked at one deal, and I know one deal is not looking at you know, what's going on across the entire country. But it was interesting that this seller of a self-storage unit, I forget, small unit, it was maybe a $500,000 or $700,000 deal altogether. But she had owned three or four of these throughout the course of her 15 to 20 years in the business. And she was sharing with me, Paul, oh yeah, it used to be, you know, 90% occupancy, and I would get this one done. I knew how to do it. And I don't know what, you know, we're trying to turn this one around, but we're at like 50%. The numbers were not working out for this seller whatsoever. And I thought she was mentioning, you know, some of the other storage units in the area. And I don't think she had data, and I didn't look into it. But my guess is that there was a huge amount of supply in Texas where this self-storage unit was located. And it was going to be an uphill battle based on, you know, the stuff that you just mentioned about the huge number of supply square foot units, however it's counted, coming on the market. So I figured I'd share that anecdote as, you know, the micro proof when we look at one deal and one seller's experience of what's taking place in that asset class a little bit over time. Make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. I mean, if you look at the amount of capital that's being spent, it's four times what was spent at the peak in 07.
And our population hasn't quadrupled in that period of time. So,
I don't think so. And even
no,
if
not
cost,
in 10 years.
Even if the cost of building is up, let's say, 50%, you're still putting in place 2.5 times as much square footage today as at the peak in 07. So it's somewhere you're adding 2.5 to 4 times as much square footage as you did in the past. It's a big number. And, you know, like any cyclical category, it's been so good for so long, people forgot how bad it was at the bottom.
It's almost like it's a small enough asset class, but it's almost like the overinvestment that you mentioned earlier in our episode here is potentially happening in a segment like that. Not a large enough segment where it could take down the entire economy like we saw with the Y2K issue or the real estate issue in 2009, but definitely an asset class, at least from my perspective, to be wary about putting my money into that area.
Yeah, I would agree. That's an area that I think once you have a recession, you might have some opportunities because some people that have, you know, too much debt on the facilities may hand the keys to the banks, and the banks really don't want to own these assets, at least not for the long term. And so you might have an opportunity to get them for a fraction of replacement costs. So that would be my thought with that asset class.
Yeah, my final thought on that asset class piece and that little comment there before we move on is that self-storage, a deal that I, Dan Breslin, would consider in a self-storage would have to be more of a land banking play, meaning it was in an area of a city that I thought was going to change in the next 5, 10, 15 years, maybe an area in the suburbs where I felt like the direction of the development and growth was heading that way. And so I would consider that self-storage not as a cash flow asset class, but more of a, hey, this could sustain itself while the land underneath potentially becomes, you know, double or quadruple the value over the course of 5, 10, or even 15 years while it pays for itself.
Right.
So that for me, that's the only perspective I think that I'd be comfortable with taking on one of those deals.
But yeah, that's we actually have a client that has owned a self-storage facility for years and years and years. And their view is it's basically, and how they're handling the asset, it's a land bank. The development's coming right to them and has begun to surround them. And when they get a really good offer, they're going to sell the land, at which point it will no longer be a self-storage facility. It will be transformed into something else.
Yeah, so to me, it feels like you got to have that kicker of a reasoning behind why the market's catching up, pushing, et cetera, to take the gamble of, you know, especially with this onslaught of inventory that's coming online.
Correct.
The final piece I want to share that I had written down here is another additional perspective 2017, we started talking about this shift in renters, you know, household formation and the owner-occupied housing, which is now growing in the numbers, where we have more than likely the wave, the demographic wave of millennials who are becoming home buyers. And that's who we're seeing buying the houses that we fix and flip. We do about 200 deals per year throughout Chicago, Atlanta, and Philadelphia. About a third, a third, a third. Some markets, you know, outperform others throughout the year, but we're seeing exactly that with the boots on the ground, Paul. It's the millennials, for the most part, who are buying these houses, who are no longer, you know, they got young children and they're kind of moving on. So it's like exactly what you talked about, you know, for the last couple of years now. It has been happening and continues to happen. And my observation with this is, I feel like this is still good news for flippers. We have some interest rate risk and some other things that you talked about, but ultimately the housing stock that exists is where the fix and flip investors are focused. And I've seen specifically, we're not seeing a ton of appreciation, you know, at the higher end, 300,000 to 500,000. But where we've seen over the last 12 months, at least from my personal perspective in those three cities, Atlanta, Chicago, and Philadelphia, is at the lower end of the price points, houses that were previously selling, you know, 100,000 and under, after they're renovated, maybe they're 100, 150,000. I'm starting to see some of that stuff selling for, you know, 10% appreciation year over year, 15% appreciation. And the product that was needing a renovation 2 years ago, it's selling for twice the price now, you know, still needing the renovation in these neighborhoods, which is good news for the people who are operating in those areas, the people who own in those areas. So I guess the conclusion I have, Paul, and maybe I have some insider comment, I'm seeing like the bottom end of the price point starting to kind of feel some of the recovery that took place over the last like 4 or 5 years for neighborhoods and higher price point, better school districts where that stuff kind of recovered earlier. And now we're seeing that bottom end start to recover as well in all three of the markets that I mentioned.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I've seen that elsewhere in other markets, and that's where the real marginal buyer is in that low end, right? And by the way, you probably wouldn't be aware of this, but manufactured housing has been doing well, and it's being put on site as a permanent housing, and it's much cheaper in certain areas where you're seeing that going in. I can tell you that we have seen that and the statistics to show that that's actually going on as well.
When you mentioned manufactured housing, Paul, is it literally like a trailer park mobile home community, or are we talking about somebody buying a lot, taking the wheels off, and it's something that's a mortgageable asset, just like a single family home?
It becomes a mortgageable asset.
And it's kind of like an infill construction type of scenario?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. We don't see a ton of, you know, the manufactured houses and the prefab houses.
Well, not
and some
in
of the
markets you're dealing with.
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot of infill stuff, small lots, lack of land in the three markets that we're in.
Right. So you wouldn't see it where you are because the land's too valuable. But in markets where the land is cheap, that is going on.
Do you have any examples of cities that you've heard this stuff happening?
I know this has gone on in some areas in Texas. I know this has gone on in some areas in Arizona. So I can look into it and get you some more feedback. But yeah, it's one of those things that I kind of keep my eye on because the market will find a way if you need some alternative. I mean, the other alternative that could potentially lower the cost of housing is prefab, right?
Mm-hmm.
And prefab is doing pretty well. And so we have a client, we'll find out if the costs really come where they say they are, but we have a client that has a prefab house that she is building, and it will lower her cost by over 30% per square foot.
Wow.
Right. So if it really does that, right, that's a huge saving,
mm-hmm.
right? And we'll be away, and by the way, it will also, you know, what I see is people aren't willing to bet the ranch on prefab yet, but they're willing to try like one house to see how it actually works out, or if there are additional costs on site that you don't know about, right, before you do it.
To actually deliver.
Right. And see what, you know, when you're finished with the thing and you deliver it to the customer where it works out, but there's a potential for a 30% plus savings here. And even if the savings just 20%, it's going to do a couple of things, I think. Number one, will allow for some lower price point development in where the land cost is high. So you can cut your, you know, price on the house, right? Or will allow the economics to work in some areas where the land cost is really high and make it more economic for the buyer. So you could actually build something. So there's some interesting dynamics there. And I want, you know, we'll have to see how that plays out, but you've got some real potential. Does that make any sense?
It does. It's something I always wish, Paul, that I had a little more time to dig into and investigate the companies, but we're in the middle of so many deals that it's just it's a second priority, you know? Thank God.
As we say, it beats the alternative.
Oh, yeah, I've been there. Don't want to go back.
You don't want to go back. So what other questions do you have for me, Dan?
Well, the only other thing I have is if you would like to share some contact info and tell the listeners what you do and what you're up to, now's the time.
Okay, thanks, Dan. Yes, we have a wealth management company called Green Drake Advisors. You can either search Green Drake or you can search me, Paul Sloat, and we will come up right on the top of the Google search. So you'll be pretty easy to find us. If you'd like to receive our monthly newsletter, go sign up on our website, and we'll have you added to the monthly distribution list. We will call you, though, to confirm they actually want our letter, although we haven't had too many people turn it down. So that would be the best way to get a hold of us. Alternatively, you can call our offices at 610-687-7766.
And what was that website one more time, Paul?
It's www.greendrakeadvisors.com.
And I read the letter, the newsletter every month when it comes out, and I enjoy the perspective. It's been a mind-expanding experience for me, and a lot of effort, energy, and great data goes into that. So I appreciate you putting that out there, Paul.
Well, thank you, Dan.
Well, cool. That brings us to the top of our episode here. Paul, thanks again for putting aside your obligations, closing the door, and spending this time here with us, and of course the preparation for all the data we talked about on here. I really appreciate you being a part of the show.
Oh, well, Dan, thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. Have a great week.
Thanks, Paul. You too. And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Keep an eye out for the next episode. We have Brandon Schwab joining us, who recently developed a method for generating $53,000 per month from a 7-bedroom house in suburban Illinois. He obviously proceeded to develop 5 more of those houses and currently has land, architectural plans, and just about has permits in hand to build 9 more this coming year. Interested in how he's doing that? You'll have to check out the next episode. Would you like to receive a pre-release notification of that episode? That is, before the email goes out. If you subscribe on YouTube or one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher, you'll receive an advance notification as soon as the episodes are published, as opposed to Saturday when the email is sent. If you prefer the email notification, just head over to reidiamonds.com and sign up. I am always buying houses, so I am always looking for deals in Chicago, Atlanta, and Philadelphia. So if you have a deal for sale, preferably one I can fix and flip, please send it over. You can contact me directly at reidiamonds.com. Also from that site, you can check out available profitable real estate deals, and the entire archive of the REI Diamond Show, totaling more than 130 content-rich, money-making, idea-packed episodes. Are you an accredited investor? Are you interested in short-term passive mortgage investment opportunities with double-digit returns? Head over to fundrehabdeals.com to check out available high-yield investment opportunities. This concludes today's episode. Thank you again for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Dan Breslin here, signing off.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.